The acquisition story that's living rent-free in developer Twitter this week is Shopify buying Tailwind CSS. 1,050 points, 405 comments. Shopify has made acquisitions before. They bought Deliverr for logistics. They've acquired various payments infrastructure companies. But this one is different because Tailwind isn't a business in the traditional sense. It's a utility that an enormous percentage of web developers now depend on. And it was built by Adam Watkin and a small team as an independent project.
From a strategic standpoint, this is Shopify buying developer mindshare in a very direct way. Tailwind CSS is installed in something like a third of new web projects according to various NPM surveys. When merchants build on Shopify, they build storefronts. When developers build storefronts, they increasingly reach for Tailwind. Shopify is essentially acquiring the tool that's already in the stack of a large portion of its own ecosystem builders.
The HN thread reflects genuine ambivalence. There's appreciation for what this means financially for Adam Watkin and the team. Building an independent developer tool to an acquisition is a real achievement. But there's also wariness about what happens to a utility that's supposed to be framework agnostic and vendor neutral once it's owned by a major commerce platform. Will Tailwind's roadmap start tilting toward Shopify's priorities? Will the governance model change?
The antitrust dimension here is worth considering, and it's a good moment to talk about how antitrust law actually works, because I think there's a lot of loose language around it. People say monopoly to mean any dominant company, but legally it's more precise than that. The Sherman Act, which is the foundational U.S. antitrust statute from 1890, makes it illegal to monopolize or attempt to monopolize a market. The key word is market, and defining the relevant market is where most antitrust litigation lives or dies. Shopify owning Tailwind doesn't obviously create a monopoly in web frameworks because Tailwind competes with Bootstrap, with plain CSS, with SaaS utility libraries. Market share alone isn't sufficient for a Sherman Act violation. You also need evidence of anti-competitive conduct, of using that dominance to exclude competitors rather than simply winning on merit.
That's an important distinction, Marcus. The legal standard is roughly that having a large market share is fine. Using that market share to foreclose competition is not. So a regulator looking at Shopify and Tailwind would ask, does Shopify's ownership of Tailwind allow Shopify to disadvantage competing commerce platforms in ways that harm consumers? If Shopify were to make Tailwind actively worse for Squarespace or WooCommerce integrations, that starts to look different than if they simply maintain it as an open source project while also using it internally.
The automatic situation is messier in a different way. Matt Mullenweg being forced by his own board into a leave of absence, 307 points, 211 comments, follows months of escalating conflict between Mullenweg and the broader WordPress ecosystem. The dispute with WP Engine, the accusations about open source governance, the way Mullenweg used his position to make changes that felt coercive to plugin developers, all of that has been building. A board forcing its founder CEO into a leave of absence is a serious governance action. Boards don't do that lightly.
The WordPress situation is particularly thorny because of the dual structure. There's WordPress, org, the open source project, and there's Automattic, the commercial company. Mullenweg has always held authority over both simultaneously. That's a governance arrangement that works as long as there's trust, but when trust breaks down, the ambiguity about who actually controls what becomes a crisis. A board can put a CEO on leave from the company. Who puts the steward of WordPress, org, on leave?
That's the question that doesn't have a clean answer, and the HN discussion is grappling with exactly that. There are plugin developers who depend on WordPress, org infrastructure. There are hosting companies whose business models are built on WordPress. The founder's personal decisions about how to exercise his open source stewardship have real downstream commercial effects, and the governance structure wasn't designed for a conflict between those roles.
The card networks explainer, Visa and MasterCard, is one of those HN posts that surfaces every few years and always gets significant engagement because the payments infrastructure is genuinely opaque to most people. 552 points, 333 comments. The key insight is that Visa and MasterCard are not banks. They don't hold money. They are message routing networks. They pass authorization requests and settlement instructions between acquiring banks, issuing banks, and merchants. The interchange fee that everyone talks about, the roughly 1.5 to 3% that merchants pay on card transactions, mostly flows to the issuing bank as compensation for credit risk and rewards programs. Visa and MasterCard take a much smaller slice for the network itself.
What makes this strategically interesting is how durable that structure has proven to be. The card networks operate something close to a regulated duopoly. There are regulatory constraints. There's Discover and Amex as smaller competitors, but Visa and MasterCard's combined share of credit card transaction volume has stayed remarkably stable for decades. New entrants, PayPal, Stripe, Apple Pay, largely route through the existing rails rather than replacing them. The question that the HN thread gets into is whether real-time payment systems like FedNow or the various instant payment rails being built globally represent a genuine structural threat or just complementary infrastructure.